Yeah, Dr. Vach, we last week we started the first segment of our discussion of the events leading up to the birth of Shmuel HaNavi. We talked about the environment that he was born into and his father Elkanah. And now we're going to move on to his mother, Chana. And can't say yet how many weeks this is going to take us. Let's see. So, as we discussed, it wasn't a story of a couple who didn't have children for a long time, and they finally did, and then he grew up to be a great man. It's almost the other way around. There was a point in history where an exceedingly great person needed to appear on the scene. And Hashem was looking to create the perfect environment to bring this great neshama to the greatest it can be. And that's why Hashem, first of all, identified the environment that we discussed last week, the area of Tzoyfin. And he looked for the choicest couple, the most. Mother Chana, and it was this very great couple that Hashem identified and selected to be the ones to raise this very great neshama that would be sent down to mamish change the course of Jewish history. So now, when we're talking about Chana, we're talking about a very great woman. So we'll discuss. Fit for this job, but said that before I actually task her with this job, I want to raise her to even greater levels. I want to raise her to even greater levels. Therefore, it was for that reason that Hashem put her through one of the most painful ordeals in a woman's life, the ordeal of childlessness. She was childless for 19 years before she had Shmuel. And the purpose of it was, it wasn't that after all this time she finally davened enough to have the child. On the contrary, all this was there. Hashem wanted this child to be born to this great couple, but also he wanted this child to be the product of all. What Hashem was investing, kiviyachol, into the appearance, into the figure of Shmuel HaNavi. All of the tears, all the tefillahs, all of the waiting and the reinforced emunah that Chana put in all these years. And I want to stress that Hashem will sometimes, when you have a story like this, where the outcome is so clear. Shmuel Mamish turned back the clock of what we call Yiridas HaDeiros and brought the entire Jewish nation to great levels that were reminiscent of hundreds of years earlier. And you clearly saw the result. But sometimes Hashem does this in a way to show, not always, not everyone's going to have the Shmuel HaNavi. Like we discussed the other way, not everyone is going to have the David HaMelech, etc. Hashem is going to show what are the results? Here we see it in material terms, in a way that you can actually see in Olam Hazeh. But the point is to realize the value of what a Jew's tears and ongoing tefillahs and emunah, and more specifically, the Jewish mother's tears and ongoing tefillahs and emunah, in terms of what they accomplish, in terms of what they're actually creating.
So at the beginning, you said if her tears didn't accomplish, like Hashem already decided he's sending you down, then he wants her to wait and put
Well, he
all
needed a
these
gap,
tears.
Kiviyochel. He wanted a gap to be covered first, meaning he said, this is the woman who's the candidate,
But
but I
she
want
hadn't
her to
done
reach
all
a
these
certain
tears.
bar. She was already a very great woman, but he wanted her to reach a certain bar. So when we say that Hashem set it up that way first, what that means is Hashem said, so to speak, if I can bring her to this bar, then she's the woman. Now, he knew he could. He knew that she had the abilities. And he put her through the ordeal that would actually bring it out.
She's stopping, or when some any person is stopping, they should believe that their prayers are going to make a difference,
That's
right?
right. That's
So
exactly the point.
she believes that her prayers do. Now you're saying her prayers made a difference in raising her higher and not in achieving the goal of having children.
Well, it achieved that too, because what Hashem was basically saying to her is, I want to bring you to the level where I can give you Shmuel. You are on that path. You are the most fitting candidate. And you have it in you to reach the level where it can actually happen. Okay? Oh, that's true. That's true. But part of the point is to understand that even when we get a no on the surface, there's a lot of yes beneath the surface. And that's part of what I'm trying to bring out here. And Bezus Hashem, we'll get to more of that. We'll get to more of that. Meaning, if a person is davening for something for years and what they're davening for never actually materializes, you have no idea what actually is materializing, what areas and what realms is it actually bearing fruit, having an effect on your neshama, on others, etc. What kinds of things it's accomplishing. And therefore, Hashem is saying, I want these tefillos. I want these tefillos. These tefillos are needed for Klal Yisrael. They're needed for you. I may be holding up something for you to daven for that will be your impetus. But lemaisa, these tefillos are achieving things that may be even greater. Okay, but we'll leave that aside for the moment and we'll come back to Techana. So, we all know how the story begins, listen how it continues, but let's see if we can address it in a deeper way. So, Chana is married to Elkanah. She's not conceiving. And she saw this as a cause for introspection, etc. She also realizes that besides her own longing for a child, Elkanah is a man who has so much to give. And therefore, she took a very selfless step. And she actually encouraged her husband, urged her husband to take another wife. Penina was, Elkanah married Penina. We all know that he had two wives. Elkanah married Penina at Chana's urging. She followed the example of Sarah Imenu. She followed the example of Sarah Imenu and urged Elkanah to take another wife. He did. And what happened was that right away, Penina started having children. She had more children and more children. And what started happening was obviously, this was deepening Chana's anger. And this all was part of Hashem's plan. What would she do with it? What would she do with it? Where would she take it to? Where would she take that anguish? We discussed the other week how Elkanah, part of his great distinction was the whole project that he made out of the visits to the Mishkan, right? The major part of that was that Elkanah was a pioneer in the sense of being a pioneer. I mean, in terms of bringing back the old things, in terms of not just going by himself, but making it a whole family Aseik. He would bring the whole family together, women, children, etc. Now, ironically, these trips actually made the tensions between Elkanah and between Penina and Chana worse. Why? Because what would happen on these trips? On these trips, when is family most emphasized? Right? At times like these, call, if we're talking contemporary times, Yom Tov, everybody's gathering around the table. In those times, it was these trips to the Mishkan, which involved offering karbanos, karbanos shlamim, which they would then feast over. That would bring everybody around the table, the whole family together. And here we began a very well-intended but painful pattern. That what would happen? Penina is busy settling her children around the table and serving them, and Chana is off to the side by herself, just watching all this happening. And that obviously is deepening the pain. Everyone had pain as a result. Rabbi Kana was extremely sensitive to Pina's pain, to Chana's pain, I'm sorry, to Chana's pain. And therefore, he would make a point of showing her extra attention on these trips to try to compensate for her feelings. He'll make a point of showing her extra attention, extra affection. What happened as a result? As a result, Pnina started becoming more resentful. It's always painful. It's painful to see, to stand on the side and watch the other woman with all her children. It's very painful to watch that the husband is giving that much more attention to the other wife. So this created just a certain painful pattern. And what ended up happening was, ironically, dafka on these trips was when the pain and the tension would reach its heights. So he would make a point of saving Chana the best portions, right? With everything going on and all the commotion, what was he trying to do? He was trying to show her, I'm not losing sight of you. I'm on the contrary, my mind is on you. And he would save the best portions for her. He would sit with her when she ate. And this, of course, compounded resentment on the other side. So Pnina responded by starting to take digs at Chana. I'm sure everybody's familiar in a general way with this story, but what that brought out was that Pnina responded by starting to get in these digs at Chana, and specifically in the area where it hurt most. And she would make mean comments like, oh, you're not busy now? Nothing to do? All right, you don't have any children. Or things along these lines. Did you buy anything recently? All right, you don't have children. Of course, I'm putting it into simple terms, but this is the idea of what was going on. Now, so what would happen? What would happen is that a vicious cycle, Chana being miserable because of the whole family setting, Elkanah responding by showing her extra attention. Pnina would respond to that by getting more resentful and digging in more, which would just make Chana that much more hurt, etc. So this was the painful reality. Now Chazal tell us something very interesting. They say, Pnina, if you just hear it at that, Pnina sounds like a cruel person. Chazal tell us it wasn't as simple as that. She was actually Mechavan L'shem Shemayim. What's that supposed to mean? That's right. Part of her intent was, how can we break out of this situation? So she figured, if I can prompt Chana to daven even harder, even more intensely, that'll solve both problems, right? Chana will have children, things will kind of equalize, even out, and that'll solve my problem also of the that feel those feelings of like I'm losing my husband's attentions.
Well, why didn't she just daven harder that Hannah should have
What's
children?
that?
Why didn't she just daven harder that Hannah should have children rather than throwing insults at Hannah? I'm just
So
theory it'll make her daven harder.
I can tell you my guess. The question is, so why, instead of doing handling it this way, why didn't she daven harder? I can tell you my guess. My guess is that A, she probably did daven, but part of the whole idea here was what Pnina realized was that the davening has to come from a very intense place, and that could only really be coming from the depths of Chana's pain. She wouldn't be able to match those feelings. So I would say, no question in my mind, that she was davening for her. Yet realizing that, like Chazal tell us, the person who's actually carrying the tzara is the one who carries the most potential to daven properly for it. So now we just have to address another point before we move on to really focusing on Chana, just in terms of the tension here. We know that the end of the story was, maybe we'll get to this, maybe we won't, but that Pnina was punished for she started losing children as Chana started having children. Now, if this was her intent, then why was she punished? So on one level, the answer is that you want to get her to daven, that still doesn't give you a heter to actually cause pain. But that's only true to a limited extent. The doctor is going to heal a patient. And the way the doctor is going to do it by inflicting pain, when no one's going to tell the doctor, well, as much as you want to help, you have no right to inflict pain, right? Doctors do that. They inflict pain and we thank them for it. But the Al-Sheikh says something fine. He says, had Chana's teasing, taunting, came only from the place of wanting to push Chana to daven more and have that child, it would have been, I don't know if I'll word the say, I don't know if I use the word okay, I'm not sure what word to use, but it would have gone unpunished. But he says, once it was coming from a combination, that's why I stressed before, her cheshbon was that it'll solve both of our problems. Right? What am I trying to accomplish here? My pain and her pain. That already, if you're going to the dangerous place of inflicting pain in order to help the person, it has to be purely, purely the shame show. Purely only for the other person's good. Once you're inflicting pain on somebody else, also for your own good, that already Hashem deems unacceptable. These are tough things, and we're talking about great people, but okay, let's just have addressed it.
Nobody should think they can help somebody by inflicting pain on them. I mean,
it's definitely,
if you're a doctor, but I mean, the situation where you think, oh, I think someone should daven harder. I mean, I think, I don't think
we would definitely not encourage such a thing to
no.
do. The only people who have a license is, like you said, a doctor, a very skilled mechanech, and a skilled parent, right? Okay. We move on. But now, okay, that's addressing Chana and Pnina. But now we're going to move back on to focus on Chana herself. So Lamaisa, what happens? At one such trip, it reached a certain peak, and Chana is mamish sitting on the side, just crying. And Elkanah sits down with her, and he's trying to lift her spirits. He's trying to coax her to eat. And he's trying to encourage her. And he tells her the following words. He says, Lama tivki, lama... Oh, that's right. He says, Lama tivki, lama loy tichli, haloy anoichi toiv loch me'asarabani. Aren't I better for you than even 10 sons? So let's appreciate what that statement was on the one hand and on the other hand. There are two sides of the coin to this. First, I'll bring out one side of the coin. It's very beautiful. The Baron Leib Steinman once met with an organization for childless couples. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's not the. Bnei Olam, that's what it's called, Bnei Olam. They're very involved, both in terms of the support and in terms of the efforts, right? And one time, a group of these men met with their Baron Leib Steinman, and he told them, he said, you have to realize that you carry an extra heavy responsibility. He said, what was Elkanah expressing when he said, what Elkanah was saying was, he was expressing his own efforts. He said, realizing the hole in his wife's heart, in his wife's life, he put in all those extra efforts to actually fill the hole personally through his own attention, much more so than every husband is. Every husband is obligated to do that, right? But he applied himself that much more in his attempt, in a very formidable attempt to challenge to be able to actually fill that hole through his own emotional support. This is Baron Leib said, you have to think about this pasuk and realize what sort of responsibility you carry toward your wives. But there was another side of the coin. And this actually was a certain, how do you call it, a makib patish. I would say that in English. But the final, the straw, yeah. So in this case, it's the straw that healed the camel's back. So, but that's what it was. What did she hear when he said that? What she heard when he said that was resignation. Right, you have me, almost like saying, he didn't actually say it this way, but it's almost like saying, you have me, forget about the kids. Well, up until this point, the Mefarshim say something very amazing. Up until this point, the Sir Moshe David Valley and the Malbim will bring this out. She was relying on the fact that she has his tefillahs behind her, Elkanah's tefillahs behind her. That was always like something that she was keeping her going. And all of a sudden, it was like a sudden flash of lightning. She said, he gave up. Right? Where did that take her to? It took her to the understanding that it's only me now. It's only me now. This actually, instead of breaking her, it pushed her. It pushed her very hard to a whole new level of resolve. And this is what caused her to just get up. She went right off to the Mishkan and invested in one of the greatest tefillos of all time. Right, we know that this tefillah that she put in now later serves, you see from the Gemara and the Paiskim, it served as the model upon which many of the halachas of Shemoneh Esrei are based. She mamish set down what we might call the paradigm, the model for all of history of what a tefillah is supposed to look like. We'll see now in so many different ways. We'll see now or probably next week. What happens? She gets up, she heads out to the Mishkan. This was the time that she was actually expecting the Mishkan to be empty because this was the time of day. The karbonos had been offered. This was the middle of the day. Most of the people who were around were now feasting at home. So she expected that the Mishkan would be empty. There shouldn't be any avodah going on now, and she would have the Mishkan grounds to herself. So she comes to the Mishkan, and it was empty, almost. Oh, almost entirely empty. The only one in the Mishkan right now, sitting right outside the Mishkan actually, was Eli HaKohen, the Shofet, the Kohen Gadol. He was sitting there. Now, the Mefarshim say that in general, he tried to frequent the Mishkan as much as possible. He's trying to constantly be drawing on the Ruchnius of the Mishkan. Now, Hashem set it up such that Dafka at this time, when she's coming by herself, he should be there so that he should notice her and encounter her. But they didn't really cross each other's paths. It wasn't like she came over to him and he was sitting off to the side. And she just came to the Azara by herself. She came off to the to, she came to the Azara by herself, found herself a quiet corner, and she took all the pain and all the everything that she'd been feeling all these years, and she just poured it all into this one packed, powerful tefillah. And this tefillah, like we said before, not only we said before, this became the model of tefillah, but this tefillah really became a turning point, not only in her whole in her life, but really in the life of the history of the Bnei Yisrael. This tefillah constituted a turning point. So what did she actually say? So I would like to spend time on the tefillah in order to bring out the power and what we can actually take away from it. And this, of course, is going to carry us into next week. But let's start. Let's start. And then we'll leave the job undone now. So let's see what are the actual words of the tefillah. The actual words of the tefillah are short enough when you look at the pasuk. She says, Batido neder v'toymar, she made a vow. She said, Hashem Tzvokos. We're all familiar with that term. She was the first one to use it. You're already seeing something very special about her tefillah. She was the one who initiated, coined this usage, Hashem Tzvokos. Okay. Imro yeah, just translating it simply. If you'll really see the misery of your maidservant, uzchatani, and you remember me, v'lo, what this means is, what does it mean you'll remember me and you won't forget me? What it means is, please allow any zchusim that I have to be invoked for this request. And give me seed of men, which just basically means is, who will be noticeable among men, someone who will be of distinction. We'll see soon. Maybe she meant that, maybe she meant the opposite, but okay, we'll see as we break it down. Sativ LaHashem kol yimei chayav. I'll dedicate him to Hashem his entire life. And in addition, I'm going to make him a nazir. A razor will never touch his head. Okay. So before we mamish really start breaking out the tefillah, No, not before we start. What's that? Why did Ailey think she was drunk? We'll get to that, Blinada. What's that? That's right. He didn't actually hear her saying anything. He just saw her lips moving, which kind of had a drunk look to it. Now, on the contrary, Chazal later learned out that that's the proper way to daven. But we'll have to discuss why at that point it actually seemed inappropriate to him. We'll see.